Welcome back to episode 191. Joe, how you doing?
I'm doing just fine, Tim. It's warmer here than it is in Texas, and my pipes haven't frozen, so I should be grateful.
Yes, you know. Yeah, you have the you have. Oh, you guys, you probably don't need heat, but you have. It's warm, and you have water running, and you're able to get some food. So, unlike so many Texans, the power grid failed.
That's a little point of data along. If you're in a ice storm, you should leave one faucet running, because otherwise your pipes will break. Because if the water expands, then you're sunk. And I really felt terrible looking at all the pictures of the poor Texans who had lost their homes and apartments to burst pipes. And it's so easy to prevent. And you really have to wonder what the government was doing in terms of getting information to the citizens.
Well, I mean, that's always been kind of like common sense knowledge in coping with cold weather. But down there, I guess it's unusually cold in South Texas.
I was going to ask you, a lot of rumors and just, kind of not a lot of data to support it. But people are worried that there's geoengineering and that Texas was targeted because of its being a red state. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, it's interesting theory, and at this point, it's just based on speculation because you don't know. That isn't to say that, speculating or being suspicious about aberrant or anomalous weather being a product of geoengineering or weather manipulation isn't completely tinfoil hat conspiracy theory territory, because there is a lot of research in that. There's, HAARP, and then for decades, various governments have been experimenting in that. I think cloud seeding goes back to World War II, and they did it in Vietnam. And I think there are many patents regarding weather warfare, and I think there actually is an international convention against it. So that's interesting. I guess if there's a treaty or international convention against it, you can be sure that various governments, particularly U.S. government, are violating it. So. I know, because Texas, it's politics and talks of secession, it's red state and all, sparked that. It is anomalous weather, very cold for that part of the country.
One of the problems with believing that the government is controlled by a secret society that wants to genocide you is it leads one to have, kind of worried thoughts about things from time to time. And this one is worrisome. Like you, I don't have any, data to support it. But Biden had talked about the dark winter. Mm-hmm. And it sure was dark in Texas during this
sure,
period.
Yeah.
So it sort of seemed like it was, logical to, this dark winter idea that had been put out, not just by Biden. There were dozens of people that were using the expression. So that I thought was interesting. And then, of course, right at the height of it, Rush Limbaugh died. And again, it's easy to concoct kind of paranoid connections. Limbaugh was, I didn't like him at all, of course, lifetime actor, one of these people that built trust up among the masses, and then when it was necessary, he could steer them into the propaganda. I mean, he was a huge Zionist and, of course, a supporter of the government theory, 9/11, But he was also, you know, with his bombast and his, I don't know, kind of cockiness, he had become kind of a symbol, wouldn't you say, or maybe not a symbol, but just a spokesperson for kind of the downtrodden white male, you know. And when he pops up in like 1990, that's when I can remember first hearing him. You know, you just come out of sort of the tail end of the counterculture. He comes from Missouri, I believe.
Yeah, he did. He worked for the Kansas City Royals. He came from sports.
Yeah, but then his radio thing. He was on, eventually he was on the same lineup with Dean Adele, the doctor, and the two of them had the largest talk show audiences in the world. And I think they were both handpicked. Adele, you know, he claimed to be a hippie, kind of, you know, nutritional orientation. But then at the same time, he was like the biggest vaccine proponent imaginable. And he even was one of the last fluoride advocates. He was talking about the health benefits of fluoride. And so, you know, long-winded here, but what I'm trying to say is that, you know, these, you know, for celebrity, particularly celebrity that has any kind of connection into culture, I think in general, they are either, you know, of the guild, they're part of the secret society, they're lifetime actors, or they're heavily manipulated, controlled. And I think in both those cases, you know, I suspect they were both just lifetime actors. I think Limbaugh especially seemed fake to me. But I thought, and this is another fantasy speculation, is that they might have arranged his death to coincide with the dark winter in Texas, because this would create the maximum, you know, psychological blow to the disoriented white male at this point, who is, you know, listening to Antifa take over the culture airways, and then to lose Limbaugh, and at the same time to see these pictures of all these middle class people in blankets trying to get food and freezing to death. You know, it's kind of a 1-2 punch.
Yeah. Now, I know he'd been diagnosed with lung cancer last year.
Yeah.
And he had been up until the 80s or 90s a chain smoker. Then he switched to cigars, which, of course, you don't inhale. As Limbaugh himself, like many people, I found him very entertaining and agreed with a lot of what he said. But a lot of his flaws, I think, stem from the fact that he was, in many ways, just a you know, a typical clueless baby boomer. At least he represented that. You know, no doubt a talented broadcaster. He did it well. My impression of Limbaugh, as I got a little more, I guess, educated and older, was he never struck me as being particularly well educated or well read in history. He was good on topical matters, contemporary political issues, matters of philosophy or literature, economics. He never struck me as being particularly well informed. I kind of stopped listening to him probably, well, that changes also with your lifestyle. But as far as really following, looking for him for some sort of insight, probably the late 90s, early 2000s, 2001 was a pivotal year, of course. It's kind of like I lost interest in him the same time that I stopped reading National Review.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And so early 2000s, you know, we develop, go past, you know, kind of grow beyond it. In many ways, you know, Limbaugh himself was a personification of, you know, boobus Americanus, you know, and he was a cheerleader for the military industrial complex, had no problem hanging out with the Bush family. He cheerleaded, I think he supported both wars in Iraq. And he was also big into professional sports and this stuff. And, you know, what we think of professional sports, I mean, it's easy to pick on baby boomers, but yeah, just his type of conservatism, you know, it would handle maybe 75, 80, 85% of the issues, but avoid the critical 15, 10% or something. He was good. You know, he never really issues like crime or social liberalism he was good on. Very humorous. I remember he had that. Remember he used to have the caller abortion, and he didn't like a call back when he took calls. He would, and that was a good humorous way to handle that issue. There was a editorial, or at least written by Ryan McCracken at the LouRockwell.com, and the title was "Rush Limbaugh was great when the Democrats were in the White House, but when the Republicans were in the White House, he was just a pro, a supporter of the regime, pro-government regime." And you'd go through that, and that's what, if you notice, Limbaugh's fame really didn't kick in until the Clinton administration. And so, and I think National Review said he was the leader of the loyal opposition on one of the covers in late 1993. And that's when he really became huge. And if you're a right-wing conservative, you listen to Rush Limbaugh. But it was also Limbaugh's popularity also represented, at least symbolized, the cultural shift in conservatism in the 90s, whereas prior to that, conservatives were thought of as being kind of stuffy, wealthy, country club, that type. William F. Buckley, erudite, sort of turgid, using Latin phrases a lot, kind of boring. Limbaugh wasn't intellectual. He appealed to a lot of lower middle class, working class guys, white, the white male, blue collar guy, and it would be the mechanic, the contractor who'd listen to him during the day. And what he also wanted, he revitalized AM radio, because prior to that, why, it was talk radio that really bred life back in AM radio, and it was his show that really revitalized, that genre, if you will. During the time I was late 80s, early 90s, I was like doing a lot of contractor work and listening to the radio or delivering, so I listened to a lot of things. I used to switch back between Limbaugh's show, and also Pat Buchanan had a same time show that I always found more interesting, because it was he would debate, he'd have another host, and they'd invite people on, they talk about issues, and they debate things. So I personally found that more interesting. But nevertheless, he really took off in the Clinton years. Of course, the Clinton administration provided a lot of fodder material. Do you remember Joycelyn Elders, the Surgeon General who thought that the government needed to teach kids how to masturbate, or we need safer bullets?
Well, she would almost be wholesome at this point.
I know she's passe. Now compare her to Dr. Rachel Levine from Pennsylvania. And so that's the funny thing. I look at Limbaugh is his activism. He introduced conservatism to a lot of people, but was it a misdirection? Was it a limited hangout? Because despite all his success, his wealth and bombast, look where we are culturally. All, he made fun of all these people, but while you're making fun of them, they were seizing all the institutions and taking it over. So what's the point of conservatism?
Well, the point of conservatism is to be part of a, in what I would call a fake dialectic. In other words, where they set two sides up, then they create emotional issues that attract, a large fraction to each side, and then they throw them these sides at one another. And then you are to believe that democracy is real because you care about the outcomes of the election. Limbaugh made the choice between Bush and Clinton seem like it was life and death,
Well, left versus right in general, right?
But the fact is, that was just ludicrous. And one of the reasons why we've gotten to where we are now, to literally a clown world United States, is because the group that really should have tried to resist the cultural Marxists and the degeneracy, they were to a large extent, I think, misdirected and certainly miseducated by Limbaugh. I mean, he would be the number one individual that I would point
Well,
to
his
as
personal life, I think, demonstrates that. Four
Yeah, and he.
marriages, obesity, these things.
Now, see, if Limbaugh had said on September the 12th, 2001, that I think this was a false flag and we're going to have to go inside the government, this is going to be tough, but Americans are going to have to roll up our sleeve and we just have to get to work, could have been a different world.
Well, this, I mean, let's cut him a little slack. Let's say he had said it on 2005 or 2006 as he did his research instead of cashing his huge checks, right? But there's no way someone could have I mean, he made a lot of money, and you don't make that kind of money without approval, you know, from the elite, the Sanhedrin, if you will. You know, so that, I mean, that's why. I mean, you don't have his success without being controlled. There's, you don't get that big organically. He was
And
set
that's
up,
correct.
you know.
Yeah.
That is, like I said, a lot of them say that you could enjoy it, entertaining. Obviously, the left is insane, so there's always a lot of material there. But little things like never drawing in the question the role like of the Jewish lobby and the Zionist powers. I think earlier on he could talk about that. I saw an earlier clip where he was talking about it. That's where he became really big, and that's funny how that he never talks about it once you become big.
It wasn't that he didn't talk about it. When he talked about it, he was supporting
Well, yeah.
Israel. I mean, he would he basically would just take the position that Hamas and Al Qaeda were terrorist organizations that came from bad places in people's hearts, and that Israel simply had to defend itself. I mean, the historical process of Zionism, the way that these attempts to fight back had developed is completely gone from Limbaugh's description of them. It's like they just emerged right out of some kind of satanic conjuring, and here they are, and Israel has to stand up to them.
It's the same thing when you talk about historical events like the Second World War, you know, or the Cold War, which ended during the early days of his show when it became popular, became nationally syndicated. Remember, he used to talk about Gorbachev, 87, 88, when Gorbachev was touring. And this was just when I started to hear about him, like 88, on AM radio. And he came up with, you know, Gorbachev would come and everyone loved him because he was a reformist. He came up with the term Gorbasm
Yeah,
or something. You know?
very pretty, yeah.
And so, and it's the idea that conservatives could be funny and also and smart, you know. And you know, before that, conservatives were characterized as either stuffy Wilmot Buckley or stupid like Archie Bunker, right? Even though the Archie Bunker character became more popular, actually, which wasn't intended. But again, these characters are set up for us, you know, as this is the stereotypical, and they create a very narrow window where these things can be discussed. And as a result, an event like 9/11 isn't going to be discussed in its detail or depth on a show like that. You're going to get the propaganda, and you're going to be dragged, you know, dragged down blind alleys or taken off course. So you, at the end of the day, after listening to it, you don't have a full understanding of it. At the same
Well,
time, you're given a lot of red meat issues, you know, like gay rights
I
or
think
abortion and things like
it's
that, you
much
know.
more deliberate. I think that at the end of the day, you can't think clearly about it. I mean, I think Limbaugh is actually sophisticated. I think that this is mind control. There is some expertise in back of all of this, which gives direction and pointers to Limbaugh as to where to take these subjects in order to keep people from thinking clearly. I mean, I honestly believe the media, as we, the mainstream media that Limbaugh was part of, is designed to keep us from thinking clearly.
Well, just like the
That's
issue
what that's
of, you know,
for.
the immigration or demographics issue, what's typical of the baby boomers, the inability to deal with that, particularly, you know, matters of race. And again, not having a complete understanding of how that issue was manipulated to dispossess them and make them lose. They're at a point now where pretty much, if you look at the heritage historic America, the higher institutions have all been infiltrated and taken away, and they seem to be destined or seem to be determined to destroy. You know, now there's open warfare declared on what's called white America, and it's openly talked about. Whereas as recently as just 5 years ago, no one it wouldn't have been this direct. And this is the world that Rush Limbaugh helped usher in or permitted, you know, with his I guess with his narrow focus, if you will, you know.
Well, he created a an electorate that was completely at the sleep asleep at the switch, that was more worried about Sharia law dominating the United States
yes.
and cultural Marxism gaining political control and having genocide of the Europeans as one of the objectives. So I can only say that I really disliked Limbaugh. I always thought he was very clever. I mean, a very good speaker. But the he at the end, he was just a, you know, he'll be remembered as being, you know, his bombast will be criticized. I mean, if you think about it, there's almost nothing in his legacy that's going to be positive. You know, nothing. I mean, he had all those listeners for all those years, and I don't think he improved the mind of a single one. And I think he damaged the mind of all of them, you know, because they just got caught up in the issues that he brought forward during a time when we really needed to be fighting everywhere the onset of cultural Marxism, which was creeping into every school board and to mm-hmm. all of the low, you know, down ballot political offices. You know, Limbaugh made fun of some of them, but you really needed, in order to, you know, mobilize European America, you needed to be much more able to criticize Jewish media power.
Yeah, you can't. Yeah, you're right, because otherwise it's superficial. You're not dealing with it. You know, I made that point about Donald Trump and the 1776 initiative, and you know, as countering the 1619 project propaganda. Yeah, but the problem is Donald Trump is in the thrall of Jews. And same with the article I sent you regarding Christian Zionists and evangelicals who support Donald Trump, and they're supposedly anti-globalists, but they support Zionism, and yeah. all the power behind Zionism, all the ultimate globalists. So there's a contradiction there, and I guess it doesn't, the contradiction doesn't manifest itself or make itself clear if you keep a superficial understanding of these things. But you can't fight the culture war without taking on these institutions, without taking on Jewish power. Who are ultimately behind these things that you're supposedly condemning or fighting, you know, like the degeneracy, the cult, you know, the sexual revolution or abortion or pornography, you know, or just the nonsense like transgenderism and this, you know, the weirder, you know, this weird stuff, because there's big money behind it and it's being promoted for a reason. And you have to be able to identify those organizations, those people who are backing it. And they do have names, they have addresses, they have zip codes, and they can be identified and attacked, but they're not, because they enjoy the privilege of being victims. You know, it's yeah. Jewish privilege, and the inability to deal with that is ultimately means that you can't fight it, even if you are so inclined. Which I don't think Limbaugh was actually so inclined. I think he's, in many ways, he was an opportunist. He was an entertainer. He may believe some of the things, but he was a sensualist. He liked the good life, obviously. And he liked being a celebrity, and you can't be a dissident and be a multimillionaire and be a celebrity in this country. It just doesn't work. I'm sorry. And you have to start, and you know, and again, as the demographics change in the country, just typical normal, you know, Americans are being excluded. There was a time, much of what America's tranquility and stability was brought about largely by its demographics. You know, you can indulge these groups on the fringe because you're a supermajority, and they effectively have no real political power, and the political power they have been granted, and they can be controlled. But as the demographics have changed, largely because of Jewish activism, and these institutions have become suborned or infiltrated and taken away, is we no longer have that demographic majority. Nor does that what remains of the demographic majority, which is like 63-64%, they don't enjoy institutional power, so the country is becoming less stable. And that's just a reality, is the inevitable politics that stems or grows from this rapid demographic changes that are occurring largely through social engineering, weaponized migration, immigration, things that are being heavily pushed currently by the Biden administration are designed to accelerate that. And the country will become less and less stable, less productive, and less prosperous in the process. And that's part of the goal. That's why the Southern Poverty Law Center, Mark Potok, was charting white decline. And again, if the, you can talk about these things, you can talk about white decline, demographic changes in a positive light, but if you talk about it in a negative light, you're an anti-Semite or you're a racist, even though you're acknowledging the same reality, you know.
Yeah, you had, I believe, sent me the list of the 8 stages of whiteness transformation.
Yeah.
And we had actually talked about this some time ago, but the chart you sent me, which I guess is now actually being used as part of a curriculum in public school, mm-hmm. Has the 8 stages, which for historical documentation, I'll just give synopsis. The first being white supremacist. Now, this is someone who wants to preserve white society and values white superiority. Then there's white voyeurism.
What is that?
you know, that's an interesting, I mean, like why they chose that term. But it says that it wouldn't challenge white supremacist.
Okay.
And desires non-whiteness because it's interesting, pleasurable. This seems to be kind of a bizarre fantasy, but in any case, then there's the good old number 3, white privilege. Now, this person may critique white supremacy, but has a deep investment in questions of fairness, equality under the normalization of whiteness and the white rule.
Mm-hmm.
4, it would be just white benefit, sympathetic to a set of issues, but only privately. 5 is white confessional. Some exposure of whiteness takes place. You know, it's interesting in that this supposedly is coming from an academic that I think Ohio State University, but you just look at the grammar of this and it's almost like from an illiterate. It's just terrible. You know, like the concepts are so poorly formed and illogical.
Oh, yeah, it's Barner Hess, a professor at Northwestern University in Chicago.
Yeah. And then white critical takes on board critiques of whiteness and invest in grammar is just terrible. White traitor, 7, actively refuses complicity, names what's going on. Intention is to subvert white authority and tell the truth, whatever cost. Need them to dismantle institutions. That's your white traitor. And then 8, this is the conclusion, the pinnacle. White abolitionist.
So was that genocide?
Yeah, this person will not allow whiteness to reassert itself. So, I mean, what can you say about the person who concocted this? Weak analytically and just filled with hate. I mean, to be able to produce something like this, you'd have to have really gone through just a process where hatred has replaced sort of this basic human empathy. You know,
that's
idea,
like Beverly D'Angelo, the author of White Fragility, who
really strange.
Yeah, I think what it is, even if they're white, they see the opportunity, and they're cynical profiteers. They're just playing they're the traitor or something, and they're cashing in on it because there's like a cottage industry now where you can be a consultant or something with corporations.
It's funny, professor. Yeah. You can become professors, but I'll bet you that what this is simply a very confused individual who has been exposed to cultural Marxism. I think he's probably been to, gender, feminists, all of these classes. I imagine he has a PhD, probably did his PhD thesis in, not allowing whiteness to reassert itself. I mean, who knows? But so this is a kind of a distorted vision of the world that has come from an individual who wasn't really trained in how to think independently, and then was, bought into the workers' paradise that cultural Marxism is offering, black intellectuals. You know, they're, you know, it's, you can just imagine how they're, how they can tempt them with the idea of like, well, the whole reason that your race has been is downtrodden has nothing to do with the Great Society program and the crack cocaine that we've been putting into it for all these years. and taking all the jobs away, it's because of white privilege. And if it wasn't for that, then, you know, you guys would be in the, you know, workers' paradise. And so he buys into this, sees like the destruction of whiteness as a shortcut to, for success for, you know, the group that he is invested in. And, you end up with stuff like this. But unfortunately, when you have the government and the all of these institutions, the funding sources are all promoting, you know, the authoritarian personality, right? Mm-hmm. Science with the idea of like, you know, like how to you know, attack white culture. Well, this is what you end up with, you know.
Yeah, someone sent me, I think, today about Coca-Cola. There was some leaked Coca-Cola company had a seminar on how to be less white. You know, why would Coca-Cola bottling company be interested in that? And I responded, what are people showing up to work on time too frequently and being too productive? Because that's what their definition of whiteness is, if you recall from the African-American Museum in Washington, D.C., you know, being punctual, you know, all these things. yeah, I mean, it's obviously what they've done with the white traders and the white abolitionists is you've fostered this ethno-masochism where you just hate who you are and your genetic background, and it's obviously very tendentious view of history, of you know. Very selective, of course, because it gives European cultures the white glove test while excusing all the, you know, the dirty, you know, details of non-Western cultures and their history of
oppression. Don't bring up the fact that the, you know, East Asian Trading Company was a Freemason project, that the slave trade was Freemasons and Jews and Arabs, for heaven's sake.
And blacks, the Kingdom of Dahomey.
Sure,
right?
Of course, And then the blacks were involved in
African chieftains,
too,
But
the idea of like focusing on whiteness, I mean, so whiteness.
And all the white slaves, by the way, millions of white slaves that were ferried off, you know.
Yeah, we talked about that, about the white slaves in the Caribbean outnumbered the blacks for many, many years, you know, during that whole time. But anyway, so the whole idea of an nuanced whiteness is irrational. It's not grounded in some understanding of history. It's the opposite. If you look at our world, what it is today, and then how did it get here, go back 200 or 300 years, the one thing that you will not see bringing about evil is whiteness. Whiteness doesn't even show up till after, you know, the World War II, when you started having the suburbs. You know, before then you had ethnicities, and the ethnicities behaved in very different ways and were far more focused on inside themselves rather than the geopolitical structure. The geopolitical power grab was almost completely Masonic. You know, if you look at it, the European Masonic power grabs, it's you know, there of course is the Spanish, you know, colonialization. I mean, obviously you can find details everywhere, but you can't rule out, when you look back at history, the influence of the Masons. You know, they're everywhere. Yeah. And they're always, for some reason, trying to get into positions of political power. And of course, they don't have any ethical restraints at all. You know, I mean, look at how they created Zionism. They think about humanity in terms of slavery and genocide, you know, and promoting their own interests. But this is the group really that, if you get into it, has that kind of, you know, just dark, evil, you know, soul that doesn't have any. Could care less about humanity. It just lies to humanity to set itself up eventually to create the slave state that we're going to have to deal with now.
Well, again, you know, there's now a new attempt to revitalize what they call the Black Jewish Alliance, and also an entertainment. And of course, this is Jewish moguls taking control of black artists for, you know, for the same old reason, is manipulating and denigrating the culture. And you know, this whole this trend to you know, apparently Aunt Jemima's being removed, you know, these product you know, characters, Uncle Ben's rice, these things, as being racist. And I don't know why they're inherently racist. It's just usually it's a you know, Southern cooking. It's a way of promoting Southern cooking as being wholesome and good and these things. But these supposedly are demeaning, but you could promote black rappers as ideal.
Sure.
Okay, fine.
But both concepts are deliberate malevolence.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, the, you know, it's sort of like the crack cocaine industry wasn't something that black entrepreneurs invented. I mean, this was something that was done to the black community to damage it.
Mm-hmm.
And the hypersensitivity, that doesn't come from, you know, kind of the normal relationships between black and white America. That comes from the media. That comes from cultural Marxism. That comes from the culture of critique, you know. I mean, again, because I'm so old, I mean, virtually like Methuselah, I've seen it all, Tim. And I can remember, you know, Watts in the late 1950s, before the riots. It was just a completely different vibe. The people were on the uptick. They were moving into the middle class. That was the aspiration. The idea of the separate, you know, kind of, you know, chip on the shoulder defense of black culture, like, you know, with the riots. And then that really wasn't the energy that I experienced when I was a kid in that era, in those areas. So something happened, and I think it's clear now in hindsight, you know, you can look at it in a broad stroke and you can see that that culture was attacked. And now it has ideas, you know, like the ones that we just talked about, the eight stages of white genocide, which don't really come from itself, don't promote its real, you know, interests, the ones in the future. It needs to, you know, this is why it'd be kind of interesting to talk to this guy, the guy who came up with the 8 points, to just see if there's any way you can get him to think about different ways that his culture has been damaged and have come up with some different ideas.
Well, is Barnard Hess, is he I don't know, is he black or is he Jewish or what?
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
I mean, it's like with this, I mean, it's almost, you know, again, why this is being promoted. Obviously, this is being put in the curriculum, is being presented to students, who's doing it, right? Why, you know? Obviously, the blacks have been sort of instructed or engineered to think this way, you know, as this all this, whether it's Black Lives Matter and, you know, like we saw last summer and kneeling and this this sort of anti-white agitation, hating whitey, that's become, you know, like the sort of the official policies of corporations and governments and these things with these training sessions, these struggle sessions, if you will. Why I'm trying to figure is why they demonize whites, okay, and say that white people are the cause for all the problems of blacks, and whether it's violating those civil liberties or denying them opportunities and these things. If that were true, if the white man is the devil, why is proximity to whites still the demand if white people are so evil? If the white people were the bane of black people's existence, why not just separate from them?
Right. I mean, that is a great and logical question. And the answer is simply that integration is given to them as part of the workers' paradise with the idea of supersession, that, mm-hmm. that they will dominate the integrated culture. But this is why, you know, getting back to the perspective I had in my theoretical discussion with the author of the 8 points, they really need to look at some new ideas. And one of them would be, well, who are the people who created this concept of integration and what was their real purpose with it? You know, if you take the broader perspective on what's going on to culture, they might recognize that the same people who are bringing in the crack cocaine are the ones who are also bringing in the concept of integration.
Yeah, that would be well, our friends are the usual suspects, the Jews, because the Jews are the ones who create the NAACP, the Spingarn brothers, and these
CIA.
Things.
I mean, it's just all imaginable aspects.
Yeah, but
of
in the early part of the 20th century, you had Marcus Garvey and the Black Nationalist movement. And he was targeted by the federal government, brought up on false charges and these things. So you had a different, you had competing factions within the Black community how to deal with this. And integration wasn't the primary one. It was like, let us develop our own community. And you know, but then they got on the integration kick. Also because it could be used as a cudgel against the South. You know, the animosity that the organized Jewry had against the South, particularly because the Leo Frank trial and subsequent lynching. And his, you know,
I mean,
Mary
if you
Fagan
look at,
case.
You know, the idea of a genocide of the European ethnicities, integration is a really important concept in all that, you know, because
especially with third world, because with the modern world, is you can weaponize migration, and which they've done, and that's been
of course,
you know, Europe, United States, and Joe Biden admits that, you know, as the country becomes, you know, it should be policy for the country to become less white, and it should be policy that the white majority go away. I mean, so what you're saying is that white majority should go away. Well, that's an interesting statement. And this is Joe Biden himself saying this. He's a political hack, so he's just doing what his master's telling him to do. But that's a great example. This is someone who opposed busing in the 1970s.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, isn't it, that the concept of ethnic genocide is virtually always a marker of you know, hidden evil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when someone like Biden makes a comment like that, you really are, you can be certain that in back of it, this guy is being programmed for evil, you know. I mean, because there's really just objectively, ethnicities has always been how people have been protected. I mean, it was the government, basically, the ethnicity. The ethnicity functioned in the way that the federal government would like to function, you know, or could function if it was not malevolent. And so why would it be attacked? On what grounds, you know? I mean, the obvious one is ethnic warfare, mm-hmm. right? That there is some hidden agenda that is not being disclosed. And so because they can't tell the truth about what they're trying to do, they give a misdirection like the concept of integration. And then they say, well, this is a, you know, workers' paradise. All we need to do is get rid of all these tensions, integrate, and then the resulting culture, everyone will be happy. But of course, you know, where are the examples of that?
Yeah, and also with integration and then white flight and suburbia, these various formerly ethnic whites become just whites and just more malleable, particularly in the age of mass communication. This is the 1960s, of course. And of course, in 1965, you had the Hart-Celler Act, immigration reform, which changed U.S. policy. Up until then, it was immigration policy favored people immigrating from Europe. Recognize both the ethnic and cultural similarities, and that it would aid, or at least in assimilation, be less disruptive. And what happened with Hart-Celler, it switched that to third world non-white immigration. And of course, at this time they said that, they said it wouldn't change the demographics. Of course, it was an obvious lie, but it shows that even in 1965, when Lyndon Johnson signed that piece of legislation, they at least they had to give lip service to that concern. You know, 40, 50 years later, if you voice that concern, you're called a racist. But it's interesting, for 40 years, between 1925 and 1965, immigration was regulated on those terms. But for 40 years, Emanuel Seller, a Jewish congressman, battled for 40 years to change that law, agitated for 40 years.
Yeah.
Why would he devote his career, 40 years of his life, to that? You know, obviously, they saw that as a long-term goal. And now, to see what's happening. And you can see when they say now that, with the changing demographics and the branding of America, you're going to get a change in politics, and that's just inevitable. Well, that's true, then maybe it shouldn't be inevitable. If this portends a different politics and culture, things like freedom of speech, Bill of Rights, Second Amendment, these things don't matter, to people from South America or from Africa or from Asia. It's a white thing, is what they're saying. And so that civic nationalist idea of America is defunct, or it never was really practical, because whatever peace we had, civic nationalism was only practical in the United States because of the demographics, the super white majority, because they had some connection to that historical, genetic. And it's not going to mean it. This is why, you have these protests that are this iconoclasm, taking on statues of Christopher Columbus, or Thomas Jefferson, or even the Confederates, but now that's because these groups don't feel any connection to it here. And the self-hating ethnomasochist whites have been, indoctrinated with cultural Marxism, so they don't even feel any connection to it.
Yeah, we talk about how you've got to organize yourself and do this kind of preparation on a local level. Boy, the situation in Texas has really given us a clear example. That one mayor, I don't know if you caught the quote, but he resigned and he said, just every person for themselves. Good
Yeah.
luck.
Like,
What a hero,
what?
So this
Well,
is
don't you? I mean, is it people pay their utility bills and they expect the services to be provided?
Right. Well, and then now, if you're looking at the utility bills, a lot of these people are going to get utility bills of $9,000 for the month, because without going into the complexities, Texas has to go to the spot market to get whatever extra electricity it can. And the way it's set up, these guys just they're asking like 1,000 times more than it's worth. But Texas is paying for it. And then the way the bills are structured, it just gets passed along to the user. So these guys are literally going to be bankrupted by their utility bills. It all seems very, it seems it's so poorly designed, you have to wonder if it's actually deliberate. That was my thought about it, is that it but again, okay, so what it does is it just shows that you have to think locally. Which is to say, the people who are now returning to their destroyed homes with the frozen pipes and all this, what they should do is try to reach out to their neighbors and create an organization and just say, look, government obviously isn't here to help. We have to defend ourselves, and come up with plans which are completely local.
Well, see, to have that, you have to have high trust communities or
You need,
societies.
well, that. At this point, I just think that there should be motivation to try to organize that. I mean, really, the first thing that you need to do is have that honest talk with yourself, and just say, look, I'm isolated. I'm here. My pipes are frozen. I've got a $9,000 utility bill. The mayor has left town and told me just to fend for myself. Maybe I need to get some friends. Maybe I need some like-minded, ethnically, trustworthy friends that we can group together, because this is pretty serious. I mean, if you saw the pictures, which I think, I mean, I always look at these things with the idea that they're basically psyops, and
Yeah, you gotta be credit.
all these people in line with the blankets. This is an image that's going out showing, this is the new status of the white kind of former middle class. I mean, you're really on your way into the trash heap, literally, of history, with this stuff. Kind of an amusing digression. So the guy who was in charge of the Katrina security and problems, remember he was the crazy general, I think it's pronounced Henri.
Oh,
He's black, or self-identifying black. He's from the Caribbean. It's kind of hard to see what ethnicity, but he self-identifies as a black man. And of course, after his top-notch job at protecting the population during Katrina. He's been, you know, promoted up, and now Nancy Pelosi has selected him to do the review of what took place with the Capitol insurrection. And no, absolutely
isn't he a partisan hack though? I mean, well, not surprising.
Well, but. No, but he came out with just to show that you know that he really is objective and he's not, you know, biased. He tweeted on January the 12th. He's talking about U.S. Senator Josh Hawley, and he says. This little piece of shit with his Yale law degree should be run out of D.C. and disbarred ASAP. Hawley and Ted Cruz are asshats. These Yale and Harvard law grads is nothing more than high-ordered white privilege. So you know you're going to get a fair shake from.
And this is the guy that Nancy Pelosi puts in charge.
Yeah, and he was one who protected New Orleans during Katrina. So. Now, this is interesting because, you know, he's clearly insane. I mean, he certainly kind of appears that way. But we'll see what his language is like.
Yeah.
Because this is important how they present, you know, as we've been through it so many times, this idea that there was some kind of insurrection is just a absurd, you know, kind of.
Deadly insurrection.
Yeah, deadly insurrection.
Siege. It was a siege.
Yeah. An attack on democracy.
The crowd had put up siege works around the Capitol and was starving them out. Because isn't that what a siege is? Like, I think when you think of siege, you think of like Leningrad, 900 days or something, right?
Yeah.
not a hour and a half of people running around the hallways.
Yeah, it's not a guy with a buffalo cape on and tattoos on his chest being escorted by police into the Senate hearing area. No, it's just ridiculous. But anyway, it'll be interesting to see the language that comes out of this guy. I'm suspecting it's going to be really, really draconian. I mean, in other words, hate whitey kind of stuff.
Well, Nancy Pelosi.
He's going to go after the white insurrectionists, the white militia. I think the language that Henri, and I think I'm pronouncing it correctly, but I could maybe not. But his language, I think, will be kind of a key as to, you know, the degree of attack on sort of normal white middle class.
Well, that's what it is.
Types, you know, as being accused of being insurrectionist.
Yeah, you had this whole white supremacy thing. As you think, you're looking around, says, "Well, you know, I'm not a white supremacist. I'm just a normal guy. So I got nothing to worry about." Over, don't think that. What do you think they think white supremacy is? It's showing the work on time. You know, it's white. But anyway, so when they, you know, this whole thing where they somehow equate the rally, the protest, and the events of January 6th to some sort of white supremacist event was anything but. But this has been that narrative, just with the language, just becomes an insurrection, a siege, a deadly insurrection. You know, so that's how this narrative or this idea has been created with the media and the politicians and. You know, they just sort of this Oprah style reaction where they're all dealing with they're sharing with us how they're coping as survivors of the event and all that. Nancy Pelosi authorized a special order where people get up and cry about their you know, express their feelings and cry in Congress. But she has said this week that Congress was going to establish an independent September 11th style commission to look into the deadly insurrection. Also, they'll get to the bottom of it. Now, they're going to look in the fact that Nancy Pelosi apparently rejected calls for beefed up security. And the mayor of D.C. rejected Donald Trump's offer for 10,000 National Guards to guardsmen to provide security and these things. No, they may not look at that or the fact that there was an apparent stand down. Some of the police, Capitol Hill police, that were expecting to work overtime that day were sent home. So there was a skeleton crew there, if you will, fewer guards than usual. Yeah, the fact that many of these of the people who did lay siege, that did insurrect, were invited into the building. You have that on videotape.
The thing is just so ridiculous. You know. It's like the shooting of the woman. I mean, if you've seen the that video clip I talked about, everything that's wrong with it. I mean, it's just this is preposterous. This is really something. I mean, you could put that clip right into a like a Three Stooges or Monty Python show, and it would just fit perfectly. You know, it's just ludicrous that anyone think that this is violent force being applied.
So she's going to, because she says, as we prepare for the commission, it's also clear from General Honoré interim reporting that we must put forth a supplemental appropriation to provide for the safety of members and security of capital. So we can spend more money on security, building walls and all that. Now, of course, Honoré is the guy who wants to, what was it, chase Senators Cruz and Holly out for for simply abiding by the Constitution. So
he's a full throttled cultural Marxist.
Yeah,
animated. You know, he's the Constitution is irrelevant. This is racial, you know, kind of supersession, and it is justified by history. And he's not going to, you know, like be back down. You know, no matter what.
Well, you also have like Lloyd Aston, who's the Secretary of Defense now. He's apparently trying to, root out white supremacy among the ranks of the armed forces. And all of a sudden, this is a problem now. Now, do you get a membership card or a tattoo, or is there some sort of identifier for white supremacists that they can identify you as such and then kick you out or bust you from the? I don't know. Again, it goes to what is a white supremacist? I mean,
it's someone that wants to live to see tomorrow. I mean, it's at this point, it's just resisting genocide.
Well, it goes back to my point. If there is indeed white supremacy, then as a white person, I am going to invoke that and say, no, I'm not, you know, stop doing this because I'm supreme, right? So obey me, right? It's like,
yeah, we have a lot of power. But all of this, it can be, I mean, the General Honoré and even the Texas event, certainly as it's being presented in the media, I mean, these things are distractions from the real malevolence that is afoot.
She's calling for a September 11th style commission. So what does that suggest? A whitewash cover up, right? even the idea you need an investigation is something I think. You don't have to get into wild high conspiracy. Not to mention, I do think that there was probably a setup here, infiltrators, and this was kind of planned. Nancy Pelosi set the people up to be accused of this stuff. But even the event itself, as it went down, doesn't warrant a real investigation because nothing really, really serious happened. And like I said, there was much more property damage to private property on Donald Trump's inauguration on January 20th, 2017 than there was at the Capitol building. Okay? So... I'm sorry. And, you know, no one called that an insurrection or sedition when they could have, based on these people's standards. You know, they rioted when he was inaugurated January 20th, you know. So there was no investigation for that. The groups behind that, gee, was George Soros behind this? Did Antifa and other groups get funding from foundations or from NGOs? Let's investigate this. Or the fact, let's investigate the role of NGOs and other foundations have in supporting the riots of Black Lives Matter and Antifa was involved in for the previous 7 months before this event. No, they're not going to look into that because that's only $2 billion worth of damage, you know, three or four dozen people dying, a 35 to 40% spike in the homicide rate nationwide, you know, thousands of people more dying, federal courthouses being burned down, police stations being burned down. Let's not investigate any involvement in that, or the involvements of maybe some of the alphabet soup agencies like the FBI in handling Antifa or not going after a Black Lives Matter organization. In fact, these organizations are rewarded, you know, with corporate funding. No investigation of that. We're going to find out why, you know, the guy with a buffalo horns was able to walk around, you know, the Capitol Hill for 45 minutes.
Right. And General Honoré has already said that he thinks that the 40% of the police are Trumpsters. They are complicit.
Well, at least half. I think maybe roughly half the country is.
Well, yeah, they're Trumpsters.
What does that mean?
Too.
I mean, so Trump. What is a Trumpster?
He's trying to arrest them all.
What are they? Musicians? A Trumpist? I don't know.
they're actually referred to them as
Trumpsters.
Trumpsters.
But what are you then? I mean, what is this member of the military? Remember the idea, I think, leading up to the inauguration, the Democrats said it'd be bad optics to have the military. Now they bring in 25,000 troops for the inauguration, when, supposedly because something might happen, but nothing happens, of course. And they're still there, by the way, or at least thousands of them are still there They've locked down or militarized DC, you know, and there's talk of them staying, you know, throughout the summer because of
So,
threats.
Tim, I wanted to digress or just for a second because I wanted to give some good news in terms of the vaccine rollout, Operation Warp Speed. They have data now in some areas, and one little data set was given by Rick Gales, who is the Walgreens senior vice presidency. He's one of the people who's really, like boots on the ground, getting the vaccine, getting the jab. And he says that they now have data on nursing homes. And it's as follows. He goes, we're very surprised. He goes, we're seeing vaccine hesitancy. Love that expression. He says, we're seeing vaccine hesitancy, particularly among those who work at these facilities, was higher than we expected. Which is, in other words, they said it's more than 60% of the employees of long-term care facilities declined the shot. Now, this is great because bear in mind that this group was selected for vaccine, inoculation as essential, and they should get it first. And of course, I also think that if they say it's 60%, it's probably 80%, because I know that they would have reason to give the best propaganda number they can. So if they're claiming 60, it's going to be higher than that. And that's a great achievement of the independent media. 30 years ago, it would have been 100%. So
Yeah,
the
because the
fact that it's over.
fear-mongering isn't quite as effective as they thought because,
It's not exact. And then the bright light, the thing that actually inspired me. He said that 20% of the residents of the long-term healthcare facilities have declined the vaccines. Now, I know a little bit about this number, so I have some inside dope because my mother is in a long-term care facility. And I've had other individuals that I've known very well that I've visited, and I can guarantee you that 20% of the residents who decline represents 100% of those who are conscious.
Yes.
Because believe me, the other 8%, the people in these long-term facilities are very feeble and debilitated. And the idea that 20%, and this was the Walgreens senior vice president admitting this, I mean, I'm telling you, that is, it's my experience is 20% is the conscious fifth, because the people are so debilitated who are at the in these facilities. So this is really good news. If they can't even get these old people who are the ones that they can really create the fear porn about COVID with to take the jab, I would say we're having some good effect here, Tim.
Yeah, and from what I understand, there's a lot of pressure put on residents of these places to get the shot, being that the people who are trying to administer the vaccine threaten people with isolation, continued isolation. And so there's a lot of pressure. I know people who have aunts and parents in these places, and a lot of pressure being put upon these residents to take the shot, and they're being threatened for isolation, which is kind of like a death sentence to many of these people.
It's incredible. And the idea that 60% of the employees won't take it, even they're probably threatened of being losing their job. This is really, I mean, this to me is indicative of a resistance to the beast vaccine, as people call it.
Well, like I suggested in the email I sent you, is maybe Bill Gates can offer a 15% off coupon on his lab-grown meat for every vaccine you accept, you know. So you get 50% off his fungi meat that he's growing.
That's another. I mean,
As he
it's
buys
just that.
up vast swaths of farmland. That's
Yeah.
what happens.
He could be
It's going to
growing
turn
our
out where you're
meat.
going to go to a store, you're going to say, there's no more meat anymore. Yeah, you got the fake meat there. So, because they don't make it anymore. So, yeah, it's not mandatory. It's just not made it, not available anymore because the oligarchs bought up all the farmland, put all the ranchers out of business. And that's the free market, by the way. You know.
Yeah. Boy, if I was people who are in areas where they can do it, I would sure be organizing food. You know, I've talked about this for over, or at least for a year, that I'm worried about eventually the food chains are going to start seizing up. There's all kinds of weird things going on with the container process and the movement of raw goods and things. And, you know, if the economy is continued to be held down worldwide, I just can't imagine we can get to the end of this year without seeing some food shortages. So this would be a time, you know, resist taking the vaccine and increase food production. And also, you know, another little tip. I mean, I'm kind of like this handyman person. It's sort of funny. You know, like if it's going to freeze, leave a faucet on so the water doesn't explode. But also, buy one of those $20 inverters on Amazon. You can plug them into your car battery, and they will last. You'd be amazed how long a car battery can last when it all has to do is just, you know, put out, you know, like this energy to this inverter. You can put two plugs and two computer ports on most of the ones that they sell. And believe me, two space heaters will keep you alive.
Yeah.
It's a lot. It'll last 100 times longer than just running the car battery. If you happen to have an electric car, like a 75 kilowatt Tesla, I mean, basically you're invincible because that thing will last for, you know, 6 months or something before you drain it completely. If that's all you're doing with it is just, you know, using it to run a space heater. But these little tips, it's sort of strange, isn't it? Because America was only like, what, 2 years ago, we had this kind of optimistic can do, you know, sort of mentality. Well, now it's sort of like it's the American can't do.
Yeah.
I mean, we can't get electricity to anybody. We can't get food. We, you know, so I think we need to change our perspective on the future and realize we got to roll up our sleeves and start organizing ourselves into viable systems, you know, that we control and just ignoring. We have to just turn off the media and you know, not listen to Nancy Pelosi.
Well, one thing that's interesting is apparently that the fate Andrew Cuomo, things that the some reason the media has appeared to turn on Andrew Cuomo. That you have this scandal in New York regarding the long-term care facilities, the rest homes, nursing homes, where he had his administration cover up, I think, by more than half the amount of deaths that occurred in his state from state regulators and the federal government. And now there's calls for his resignation, impeachment. The Federal Department of Justice is investigating. The Letitia James, the state attorney general up there, is investigating the Cuomo administration and covering this up. And just a few months ago, you know, he had received an Emmy. He had written a book about how successful he was.
Santa was going to bring him presents.
He was the exactly. And he was a symbol of leadership. He was a good dictator, we were told. Now, just almost overnight, he's becoming a villain in this. And for some reason, the media has turned on him. And I'm trying to figure out what's the politics of this. I don't know, maybe certain factions within the Democrat Party, maybe within the Biden-Harris administration, don't want to see him as a competitor. Maybe Letitia James has sights on the governor's mansion. If Biden's next stimulus bill or proposal gets passed, a lot of money is going to be pouring into New York. Maybe they want to control that largesse. It's interesting to figure out, you know, it's interesting because it's hard to figure out what exactly is happening, but all of a sudden, both he and Gavin Newsom seem to be on the chopping block.
Well, they will do this. You know, it creates this idea that democracy matters and that you can get rid of corrupt people. You know, they'll expose Cuomo because he was he lied about the nursing home carnage that he created. Right. OK. But this will just distract from the fact that he locked the city down and destroyed hundreds of thousands of businesses.
Yes.
For a fake pandemic, right?
So, and it also solidifies the pandemic narrative, which
exactly
is the bigger
so you
issue.
Get the, you get the distraction, and then you get the big hubbub, and you feel like democracy matters, that there's some kind of control because you get rid of someone who's bad, but you just replace him with de Blasio becomes governor or something. I mean, it's just, see, the again,
he cut down the population 13% in the nursing homes. There's a lot of savings there.
Yeah, you could run on it as a ticket, you know, like cost saving. But it's just, it's there, the way that this system is set up, there isn't any points where we get to enter it and affect it. It's a closed loop. It's just a dictatorship that has the veneer of democracy to keep the people that it controls fooled. Newsom is the same thing. I mean, you recall we got rid of Gray Davis and replaced him with Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know, California was ludicrous, and so this will I'm sure if you get rid of Newsom, which I incidentally, I mean, just back up. To be honest, I have worked on the recall Newsom campaign. I've actually gone out to the tables and tried to get signatures and stuff. I mean, I think it's really good optics. It's a way to keep the issue of the pandemic and the government inappropriate response in front of the public. So I've tried to help it along. But I know at the end of the day, the Democratic Party, you know, is controlled by the Getty family and the Rothschilds. You bloody well believe they've got a Newsom 2 coming down the pike. It'll probably, if I had to guess, Newsom and Cuomo will be basically attacked as examples of white privilege.
Well, yeah, here we have, you know.
And there'll be like a, you know, Latino or an African-American that will be the replacement puppet.
Yeah, and it's, you know, then you'll have, you know, Harris, who will be installed as president. Biden, well, or, you know, it could be that, you know, Biden will serve out his term, but he'd be like Woodrow Wilson after a stroke, and he'll be there. He'll be playing Mario Kart with his nephews at Camp David, and it'll be the faction around him that runs everything. It'll be the Swamp and, I don't know, Susan Rice or his wife and the faction that controls him. Because
it'll be the, you know, the secret society and the Masonic handlers. You know, this is just a dragged out version of Weekend at Bernie's. Biden will be electronically controlled. I mean, he'll literally be a physical puppet if that's what they want. It'd be kind of amusing.
But I think he already is.
Yeah, I mean, probably he's already there, basically, to some extent. But I mean, you know, you could imagine how they could, you know, these people probably have a sense of humor, and they might think, well, it's time to stop with this idea of a living human as their president. Let's give them a, you know, a corpse that actually just moves around a little.
Oh, like a Max Headroom type.
Yeah, it'd be, that's right. It'd be like, it'd be animatronic, you know, and it'd be CGI. There'd be like, Biden in outer space, and, you know, Biden climbing Mount Everest, and just.
But look at the ages of our political leadership. It's Nancy Pelosi. Pelosi's 80 years old. Biden's 78, going on 79. And I know people in that advanced age often a lot of medication, and there's a question about the effects of things like statins just on their thought processes. And Nancy Pelosi is not all there. She's not stable. I mean, she's. No. This impeachment thing was a distraction, but it also, it just looked awful. You know, the second impeachment for a former president, and she's calling for a commission investigation, just dragging it out. And idea is, you know, they want to keep Trump the issue. You know, if you want to, you know, I said it before, if you want to keep Trump the issue, you shouldn't have stolen the election. but they, you know, but at the same time, again, you have, I think Mitch McConnell, he's been the senator from Kentucky since 1984.
It's just incredible. Yeah.
I mean, you know, and then he gets condemns Trump after he's acquitted. You know, he's acquitted 57-43, seven Republicans voting for conviction. So 57 senators voting for an impeachment of a president who's no longer in office. Presided over a senator when it's supposed to be a.
I know. While the country is literally collapsing culturally, the food supply is at risk, and we're trying to impeach a president that's you know, historical. So this is a clown world, man. This is, you know, we need to always point out that there's an artificiality, you know, to the media reality we're getting. It's CGI. Biden, if they turn him into an animatronic creature, that with no real physical presence at all, he's just a completely, we only see videos of him, climbing Mount Everest and stuff. I mean, this would just be a continuation of what we've been subjected to really since we're into World War II, mm-hmm. since they got TV in front of us, So, I mean, it wasn't circumstance that the initial, national channel had the all-seeing eye. CBS would, cut out there and just gave it the, the right off the bat shows you where it was all going to head. We have to just keep our wits about us, try to unplug from all this crap. I think the story from Texas, Tim, is, get together, share wisdom. There should have been someone in Texas. All these pipes, it really bothered me because it was such a simple fix, and the fact that they weren't doing it shows that the communities aren't organized to defend themselves. It's a good example. This is what we have to do. If these communities had been set up to defend themselves, they could have, no one needed to have frozen to death. No one needed to have even been miserable because they could have had adequate uses of electric devices. Like I said, the little inverters that plug into cars. There could have been 100 things that the communities could have done to protect themselves. The fact that the mayor bailed and he said every man for himself, I think this is great. The people should say, you're right. And we're not even going to go through the system that produced that cesspool of a mayor. We're just going to organize among ourselves and try to create our own culture.
Mm-hmm. So, well, in order to do it, you got to be allowed to do it.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you got to fight for it. It isn't just going to happen.
So, okay, Joe.
Tim, it's, this will be another exciting week coming up. I'm sure of it. And, we'll talk next week.
Yes, and of course, by next, my prediction next week, no one will be talking about Texas weather. It'll be something else.
Oh, it'll be completely gone. It will not even, it'll just disappear. But like an ice sculpture, at a ski resort, it will, yeah, in the spring. It'll just have melted and it'll be gone. Yeah.
For some other crisis or problem.
Some other crisis. Own Ray will have discovered that there was a conspiracy among the police to attack Nancy Pelosi's office or something. It'll be some other absurd clown world event. Doesn't matter. We just got to keep, think of the lonely Texas guy and family inside a home that was being shattered by frozen ice pipes. I mean, that individual has got, if he survives and they survive, he has a lesson that's been given to him, do not accept isolation and loneliness. Don't. You just can't do it. We have to go out the first thing and try to reconnect with one another.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so you have a network to depend on. So
network. Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Take it easy, Joe.
Bye, talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.